Welcome back to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zierer.
And I'm Daisy Alioto.
And Daisy, who are we talking to today?
Today we're talking with Colin Nagy. He is a travel and hospitality writer, most regularly at Skift and Monocle. He's also the co-creator of the excellent Why Is This Interesting newsletter. And he's a serial strategy executive currently at...
Yes, I am excited to talk to him. I'm a big fan of their newsletter, particularly the Monday Media Diet.
Column. Yeah, I've done one of those. Have you done one?
No, I have not.
We'll
bring that up. I really enjoyed Matt Klein's recent one there. It was a good one.
Oh, I got to go back. And sometimes I miss them, but Matt Klein is a friend of the pod. I don't know if he's a fan.
We can fam of the pod.
Fam of the pod. Yeah, sure.
Pod fam sounds like a startup where they offer you prepackaged community services for your podcast.
It sounds horrible. I'm sure there's like 10 different people doing that right now.
Mm-hmm. Pod fam, if you want to work.
They're all autonomous AI agents. We create an autonomous AI agent community for your podcast to promote it.
Anyways, Daisy, what's up in Dirt World?
What is up in Dirt World? Well, Dirt World is Moss World this week because our collaboration with PF Candle went live. If you go to the PF Candle company site under bundles, they now offer the Girl Moss bundle, which is a really cool combination of existing products that they had that kind of fit into the meme that came out of my viral 2022 tweet, the Girl Moss.
How viral did
Girl Boss is dead. I don't have the most current numbers, but it crossed over to Instagram. There's fan art. Like, just trust me, it's viral. Anyway, so there's an amber moss candle. They have Enoki cedar incense and then a diffuser in the geranium moss scent. Mm-hmm. And all of these scents are amazing. They go really well together. And I like that it's like you're not getting three candles or three incense. You're getting like a little bit of each.
Yeah.
So check that out if you're in the market. Mm-hmm. I went to Magazzino yesterday. Do you know what that is?
No, but I did see it on your Instagram, and you have, I think, talked about it here before as a big fan of it when I spoke about the after I went to the Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia. I think you were talking about it.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite places in the Hudson Valley, and I haven't been there since they built their extension, which is a cafe. I joined so that members can go to the cafe and some other privileges. It was my first time going to the cafe building, and it was so beautiful. Like, you really feel like you're in the Tuscan countryside because it's nestled into a hill in Cold Spring. And they Cold have Harbor. Sardinian donkeys on site. Didn't want to come say hi to me this time, but
that's a pity.
It was cool. It was very cool. You should get there. I think
I should.
It warms up, you can bring a picnic. I only had a Americano and croissant, but I want to go back and like try their full menu.
Yeah. It's never really good though, the food at a museum.
Well, I think this one might be good though. The exception.
Yeah.
I did see in Feed Me that they are redoing the catering at the Met and that the restaurant group that has Via Carota might be behind it. Did you see that as well?
No, but at the Whitney, Franchette did the kitchen, which I haven't been to the Whitney in a couple of years. But my sister went last time she was visiting, and she said it was really good. Anyways, Colin is now with us. I'm gonna let him in.
I just had a million-dollar idea. It's called Podcast Candle. And it's a candle that you light when you're on a podcast.
I think that's an interesting because we have everything is now a podcast, right? Mm-hmm. So you have the omnipresent podcast mics and everything. I think I wrote a witty about this back in the day where it's like, in the same way that Gary Vaynerchuk would always have people like following him around, like camera, like videotaping him, like having a podcast mic in the shot automatically like imbues authority.
Pod News, I think they're called, which is a good like daily industry newsletter about the podcast industry. Their issue this morning, it led with something where this guy is like recording a podcast in an elevator for an hour. And I think he was talking about like Hamilton or something. But the point is, he like on one side of the elevator, he had a camera set up, and then he's stood on the other side, and people come and go between him, and he just spends an hour in this elevator recording.
Do you think he would want to collaborate on podcast candle? I think elevators need candles as well. They're often very smelly.
I think that's like an air quality hazard.
And by the way, when Colin says podcast. Witty is short for why is this interesting, which is also very witty. Mm-hmm. I do think that the mic in the frame aligns with this idea of para content that we've been talking about. And yeah. Ruby wrote a great piece about this. My mic is out of frame right now.
But I'm feeling really self-conscious. It's the only in-frame mic on the Riverside.
It's complicated.
You sound great.
Well, that's the idea.
But if you take it to its logical conclusion, like if somebody being in a studio imbues a sense of authority and legitimacy, you know, as a shorthand, I think it's like that's the sort of Gen Z equivalent of boomer brain, where it's like, well, I saw it on Facebook. Like, I think the Gen Z and Alpha equivalent of that is like, well, I saw it on a podcast. And it's like, first of all, that doesn't mean anything. Second of all, you didn't even see it on a podcast. You saw it on two people talking with mics. You know what I mean? Like, that's crazy, man.
It's credibility laundering because you now see all the fucking ads being like, you know, I got to tell you, I was really having this hard time finding a great workout shirt. But thanks to, you know, and it's like, it's like the conversational framing, and like as a device, it's pretty powerful. So I like the point of the sort of boomer credibility of I saw it on Facebook. Now it's like I'll buy anything just because someone credibly talked about it with a podcast in the frame.
Totally. I love this idea of credibility laundering, and I saw this tweet last week from this person, Ted Childish. It was like a kind of a slide deck, how to industry plant yourself. And I'll just read like
sounds pretty slides. Childish to me.
So number one, start your own fan accounts. Number two, build narratives around yourself on external platforms like Reddit and Discord. Three, fabricate tweets that profile you. And then I don't have to read these all. There's quite a few. It goes all the way up to 12. There's have people create deep dive videos about you, be mentioned by an artist in their song, be a guest or mentioned on a podcast, and so on and so on.
There's this guy. What's his name? Aman Ghazdi or whatever. He's like one of these kind of like planets that exist outside of the toxic Tate universe. Mm-hmm. And he's this guy that just like literally was like built like a company, just like doing ads for people. But he did this thing, the early kind of Gary V playbook of like, I'm going to just have a bunch of profile things, everything I do. And I'm just going to have it sliced up and atomized across TikTok and social media. And it's super garish. It's like, here I am in Laura Piana. These are my favorite shoes that Laura Piana and like here. And he would like rent a place in Dubai, but like do a walkthrough as if it was his own place. And so it's exactly this sort of like the funhouse mirror flooding the zone. And I think that the flooding of the zone is like also how a lot of the Tate stuff metastasized, right? Because I think that he built this system where like a lot of the acolytes were being incentivized to like repost clips to like get points or something in his like shitty thing. And so that my question is like, when is there a margin call on these sort of things? And I think we're like almost reaching the margin call on this, because the Galloways of the world, it's like it comes off as so fucking pedantic of like having just all the actually what the men today need to be thinking about. And it just it comes off as so fucking pedantic, and it's everywhere. And it's like it almost has the opposite of the intended thing, which is the credibility and influence. It actually chips away at your credibility and influence, right?
What comes next?
I don't know, man. That's the I think I've been thinking about this a lot. I think the Noah wrote a piece today in Why Is This Interesting about how if there's going to be hard paywalls around everything, the new like influence sphere is like almost like a new branded content renaissance where you're like doing very, very well written things outside of the paywall. Because that's the things that the LLMs are going to be ingesting. And like, if you get the tagging right and this and that. So if you're like a think tank that's trying to tilt the discourse on a topic or if you're like a travel brand that wants to come up as like the best whatever in whatever city, like I think that it's almost the new, pardon the reductionist phrasing, but it's almost like the new like SEO in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think that the early riff on this is like, oh, AI is going to generate all this like slop and bad writing. I actually think that like this could be a renaissance for like very good writing, mm-hmm. Written by people that can also like affect the broader narratives and the layers in which people are like interfacing with information. So I find that to be like very, very intriguing, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. as an influence vector, right? Mm-hmm. Like the next phase of this might not be podcast bro manufactured podcast. It might be like people that are front running the market with this sort of thinking. And, you know, and obviously there'll be a margin call on how quickly that happens, right? So.
Yeah, I wrote a white paper over the summer for like a prospective taste coy that would essentially act as PageRank for influencers and publishers, where it would, your accumulation of taste would signify to the LLM in the same way SEO did to Google that you are both credible and relevant. But it would be like a multi-node economic exchange. So you could accumulate taste token by contributing to the overall knowledge of these LLMs, but the LLMs themselves would also need to build credibility by linking to legitimate sources. It was just like a white paper. It was totally like,
it's a really interesting idea. And the person that would be like an amazing like thought partner on this is and I think you know him, David Marks in Tokyo, that, mm-hmm. that wrote about like the relationship of taste and status and capital, you know what I mean? And to date it's something that has been forged in very like loose and ethereal terms, you know? It's like public image making or writing or people that have like forum wasta, you know, or clout. And but I think figuring out how to formalize that with technology is kind of interesting in terms of like influence rank, right?
David and I share a Neuralink, and he had the misfortune of being in the audience where I gave my taste economy talk that came out of this white paper. So I wish I should get in touch with him though. We've been relying a lot on the Neuralink, and I should probably actually communicate with them.
He's a cool cat. And what I love about him is I actually somehow stumbled upon his paper at Harvard a long time ago, mm-hmm. in terms of what he did with like bathing ape and the kind of cultural study of that, which was, I think it was his thesis at Harvard. And it was funny because we got to be friends since just through other shit. But I just remember, I think it was like on one of those forums, like Super Future or something like that. And it was like finding some Harvard white paper that he wrote on bathing ape back in the day, which is kind of funny to think back on, right?
He also has great pants. Francis, go ahead. I know you're chomping to say something.
Very stylish guy.
So I was hanging out with a couple of friends this week who understand a lot more about crypto, the blockchain, etc. than I do. I'm
wait, who?
Blockchain illiterate. You don't know them. One though.
You don't know that.
You don't know my friend Mazin and my friend Harris.
Harris who?
Harris Rosenblum. He's come up on this podcast before. He's part of Do Not Research, Josh Citarella's group. But okay, so they tried to explain this to me like five times, and I kept being like, okay, so it's like this. And they're like, well, kind of. It's actually, so ultimately I just don't understand this concept, but I imagine the two of you might, of the Oracle problem on the blockchain, which I looked up a definition here. It's the security, authenticity, and trust conflict between third-party oracles and the trustless execution of smart contracts. So in the way that I am probably misunderstanding this thing, the way you're talking about like this taste validator and this like taste coin or a way of like authenticating taste digitally on chain, whatever, like this seems like a quite the example of that, where it's something that is so abstracted and distributed that there's just no way to do it.
Well, permissionless networks can also have their own logic though. Like we're working with this company, Refi Labs in Zurich, on a Web3 consumer app. And Refi is like basically permissionless software networks, but it's domain based. So every domain built on top of it can set their own rules and logic. So permissionless doesn't necessarily mean trustless. But I guess the Oracle problem is like a problem of manipulation, right?
I'm not sure. I understand it as a problem of like, you can't one-to-one translate information from one system to the other. Like the, or I think the way the context they were talking about it in was like relating traditional financial markets to crypto. Like there's this, all this context that you can't really put on chain in a meaningful way that creates this translation issue.
I think I understand what you're saying. Did they talk to you about stable coins at all?
Maybe.
Okay.
I was not following. I'm not a very smart person.
Stable coins are meant to operate with traditional market logic on the blockchain. Mm-hmm. And even Bitcoin is expected to correlate with what's actually happening in the stock market. But that does go against the very idea of Bitcoin as a store of value that's independent from traditional market logic. So people get very emotional about this. Colin, I can't tell if you're thinking or your eyes are glazing over. Both would be valid responses to this conversation.
I'm thinking, but I'm like trying to call my friend Joe Wiesenthal because he's like, this is very much his. I'm like,
he's a fan of the pod.
Can I phone a friend? He also did one of the best like Monday media diets in Witty that ever existed. Mm-hmm. It was just so deep and thoughtful. And yeah, that's pretty much the first person that came to mind when I was like trying to keep up my processing power on this particular conversation.
Well, okay, so let's get off this, take a leaf out of the Monday media diet. And how about you tell us the story of a rabbit hole you've recently fallen deep into?
Ooh.
The thing that I've been doing recently is I've been just using some of the LLMs to put together like reading plans for myself. And I, after watching Landman, the Taylor Sheridan show on Paramount Plus, I was like, oh, I want to do a reading plan about sort of oil, right? Venn diagram between oil, geopolitics, Texas, you know, all of that. And it put together a pretty awesome reading plan for me. And I'll give you a little bit of a download of what I'm going to be getting into here. Let's see here. So some of them were like basic B books, right? You know, it's mm-hmm. like, cool. Thanks for the, like the Danny Yergin rec, you know, mm-hmm. that's the obligatory. But obviously like Oil 101, which is like a little bit of a technical foundation of like how these markets work. Steve Cole is one of my favorite writers, and he wrote a book about ExxonMobil, sort of like private empire, ExxonMobil and American power. You know, there is that MBS book, Blood and Oil, which is kind of probably dated at this stage in terms of like the rise of MBS and kind of like Saudi strategy. An older 70s geopolitical book called The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Modern Middle East. A very juicy, gossipy book, which is called The Big Rich, The Rise and Fall of the Greatest Texas Oil Fortunes. So, and then obviously like the James Baker book, which I've read, which is The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of James A. Baker. And then some other like weird deep cuts. You know, there's something about Nigerian oil corruption, A Swamp Full of Dollars by Michael Peel. So I guess my whole life, you know, co-writing, why is this interesting, is quick wormholes that I have to some way cap because I have to move on into the next one. Another one that I was excited about the other day was the rebuilding of Aleppo and also just like the kind of cultural heritage of how we, you know, rebuild things. And I'll kind of talk about that a little bit. So much of like Assad regime, like curated historic sites to tell a very specific story, Syrian Arab nationalism, anti-colonial resistance, and sort of Ba'athist triumph. Certain areas of culture and history were like downranked in the algo. Like Turkish inscriptions disappeared during 1990s restorations of historic buildings. Late Ottoman structures were selectively demolished to create an artificial historical purity, but it wasn't real, right? So it's like the finger on the scale of kind of like culture and rebuilding. And so now, with the rebuilding of a lot of that country, there's a lot more people at the table, and how like the say of how things are preserved, right? And I got to this point where it's like, you know, everyone still doesn't have a fair say, right? You know, you have like UAE and some other Gulf states that have an eye on big reconstruction contracts. Craftspeople with knowledge of traditional building techniques might have a little bit more authority. But like, who gets a say? So there's a melange of pressures, influence, and prioritization. And like, what will be the dominant point of view when it comes to reconstruction? So the way I kind of started this piece is, it's just like, I've been thinking a lot about who gets to decide how we remember, right? And the politics of reconstruction and stuff like that, which was a really fun wormhole. But I'm in the business of wormholes, so I kind of have to like move on from them to the next one.
So you give a long list of books right before that. How do you, like, how long are you going to spend? Are you going to read all those books? Are you going to buy them all and read parts of it? Like, how?
I think what it, and sorry, I'm jumping from topic to topic.
No, go ahead.
So I apologize for moving like ADD style through things. But what I'm going to do is, I'm just going to buy them, and I tried to create like a reading plan, like you would in like a classroom or something like that, and to do a self-directed study. And what I also find pretty interesting is, you can like then kind of ask questions or have a little bit of a dialogue to like go deeper on some of these things. And again, it's not like I'm trying to do a master's or a PhD. I'm just trying to get to a level of deeper understanding of something that, unfortunately, I probably have a cursory understanding of from like reading the FT and the Lex column and stuff. But I'd like to.
You're auditing the class.
Yeah, I'm auditing the class. But highly recommend reading plans for like any topic you want to wormhole on, because the fidelity of stuff that I kind of get back on. I read the book, The Year of Living Dangerously, which was kind of like Indonesia 60s, you know, coups and politics. And I had them spin up a, you know, I had the, I think it might've been Claude spin up a reading plan off of that. And we got to like very interesting, like levels of fidelity, where it was like, oh, this, you know, CIA thing was just declassified 5 years ago on this factor that like historians hadn't actually priced in. And so it's very interesting to use these types of reading plans to almost think like a junior historian of like, what is the thing that not everyone has seen? Another example of that was when you think about, you know, the Brits, either in the Foreign Office or MI6, that were actually like working for the Soviets, you know, the Kim Philbys and the Anthony Blunts. Blunt has a memoir that like sits in a private room that no one's read, or few people have read, in the British library. And it's like rate limited, right? You know, it's like, it's very controlled. And it's interesting, you know, like I love the idea of, even though I'm not devoting my life to the history or writing a history of some of these subjects, it's like, I'm looking for that little informational piece of alpha that everyone hasn't read, because it's interesting, and it can be like an unlock or like an insight.
This reminds me, I was thinking of that Wu-Tang album the other day that like they I forget.
The Martin Shkreli one?
The Martin Shkreli one, where he bought it. Nobody could listen to it, but.
And now everyone can.
I've also been thinking a lot about the, you know, the idea that information wants to be free, versus when we talked to Mike Pepe, and his argument was that no, it doesn't. Information is labor, and, you know, people in control of platforms that distribute and traffic in information want it to be free, because that is free labor. But
it also becomes a way to buttress the ideology of that platform.
Yes.
Platforms are not.
But I'm interested in this rate. I like that you use the term rate limiting. I think also going back to the context of that piece that Noah wrote today in Witty, that maybe in like the AI era of so much content and slop, et cetera, rate limited information becomes something that people are using more, you know, like non-digitized assets.
That's an interesting idea, right? Where it hasn't been priced into like the public market, right? I love this idea of like information gatekeeping, because, you know, it used to be a thing where DJs would be playing a white label and they'd be like covering it up, you know, like you can't train spot this because this is my secret sauce, right? Mm-hmm.
But what's the line between taste and information, right? Like where you go to vote should be public knowledge, right? And how to give input on new rules in your local vicinity, whatever that, but that's different from somebody's taste. Like, I think you could gatekeep your playlist, right? But there is certain knowledge that should be open sourced, and the blurring of the lines between the public and private sector will only like further destroy things that are truly meant to be archival, free information and historical record.
Hard paywall core, right? So for example, like you got to pay extra to get to the best pieces of writing in Esquire's archive, like from the 70s, right? Is that what you're getting at? Or
yeah, I mean, to me that's like, that is like lifestyle and taste and publishing information that it makes sense to pay for. But like what I'm talking about is like even before DOGE and, you know, the sort of defunding of stuff like the National Archive, where they are preserving information for the public, there are things that that were paywalled or rate limited that, to my knowledge, shouldn't be. Like, for example, Ancestry.com. That was something that you had to pay to navigate, even though half of it is like census data that should be free for all of us. And you could argue, well, you're paying to access the interface. But I think that being able to like search a census or immigration records to know where your family is from in America should be a public good that is like, you know, that the right and the left should both be able to agree on. So like, why was it basically like monopolized by the Mormon church?
Interesting. Yeah. And people providing value by assembling or structuring data from disparate sources and slapping a membership on it, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing I wanted to get both of your opinions on is I think the Emiratis are being very smart in terms of a lot of the AI strategy as it relates to geopolitics, as it relates to governance. But what's very intriguing, and I wrote about this a while back, is like they're developing the first sort of like Arabic language LLM, right? And what's very intriguing about that is, as part of that, I would imagine, and I haven't done the math or I haven't, you know, probably infusing it with Islamic mores and codes and rituals and basically being like, this is going to be the source of truth for Arabic speakers that are searching for information, and we need to control that, or at least have a head start on that. And I'm so intrigued by that idea. Obviously, like, they're way out in front of the implementation of AI in like lots of areas of society. They're thinking very interesting and smart things about data centers and deserts and things like that. But I just think that like Arabic language LLM being funded and sort of like underwritten by them is an incredible source of like control and stewardship, which opens up a whole can of worms in interesting ways. So I was just curious if you guys were tracking that at all or not.
I'm not, but I did my senior project on architecture and Islamic values and how basically like Islamic values are manifested in urban planning and the architecting of cities. And there's this principle called like Ummah in Islam, which is like the idea of the international universal Muslim community. But you could see that feeding really well into this idea that there should be an LLM that takes into account like the Ummah, right? But for one stay with a particular political ideology of how like Islam should be practiced, to monopolize that, I think is like pretty dangerous, right? Because there's a lot of values that like the UAE have that are just like pure capitalist values that don't necessarily serve like for example, migrants from a poorer Islamic country that are coming to do dangerous construction projects. So, you know, I think there's like an interesting spiritual argument for why something like that should exist. But from the perspective of like economic and political fairness, when there is like one nation that is controlling it, you're obviously going to like run into issues.
It's, and you make such an incredible point, right? Because I haven't articulated it in my mind as well as you just did, but there is a pretty interesting like spiritual argument. But in this instance, it's being sort of driven by sort of a national security advisor, right? You know, according to the FT, like one of the main drivers. And to unpack this a little bit for like your audience here, the layer that sits on top, you know, currently called alignment, sort of ensures the model doesn't go too far off script. It offers a lot of editorial power to its creators, right? So obviously, trying asking ChatGPT to do something violent won't give you an answer. But in this case, there is the ability to sort of like embed mores or framing on top of this, right? And so the weighting of this, even if it is intended with all the best intention, it comes with a lot of like spiritual and philosophical questions. Mm-hmm. You know, I think right now a lot of are naturally biased towards the Western world since so much of the training data comes from those countries. Going a level deeper, it also means a focus on Western or Judeo-Christian values. So purposefully or not, a lot of like the LLMs are like, you know, on a certain intellectual or spiritual operating system. So crazy. But also when you think about the 400 million plus Arabic speakers, there is also a need for this, right? For people to interface with these in their native language. But it just, it opens up a, this would be an incredible sort of like PhD study, right? For someone, like, because it, there's so many vectors, Daisy, as you rightly point out, there's like the spiritual vector, right, of, or like a shared vision for Islam. But then obviously there's so many different interpretations, sects, things like that. But then also the desire for a company or a country to exert control or influence. And I think that that's what's happening here, is like we are going to front run the sort of influence because we see it before other people do. Mm-hmm. And so they are front running a lot of things as it relates to strategy and AI. So I use
ChatGPT as like one node in the fact checking process. And what I'll do is I'll paste something in and I'll say, is this factually correct? And then it'll give an answer and I'll say like, what is your source for this? I'm curious whether you did this with your like reading list as well. Like, hey, where are you sourcing these from and how are you weighting them? And there's been times where it said, it's come back and said, when I say like, give me like actually link to the source for this, don't even list them, like link out what contributed to your knowledge of this. Which to me is the same as like scrolling to the bottom of a Wikipedia page. Yeah. They'll actually self-correct to be like, I told you the wrong thing. Like once you ask for the source, or they'll say this, 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 and I'll like click through. And then I like affirm the quality of that source for myself and whether I think that constitutes like an adequate fact checking.
There's illusions that pop up, right? Because like sometimes you're like, if you're trying to write about Syria today, it's like, oh, sorry, the training wasn't accounting for the fact that like Assad fell because my last training data was October. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I love that you're saying that. And I think so much of this is like literacy of like double and triple clicking on the source material. And I didn't mean to cut you off there. So if you were,
no, I think like the professors who are trying to account for the inevitability of students using this in the classroom are just trying to shift that sort of media literacy into how it applies to like using this as a tool, which is like, I think really is fundamental to what should be taught in like a liberal arts education anyway, which is like how to think. And I sort of ran into this when I was fact checking this piece that we did on Djokovic, tennis player, because am I saying that correctly? Anyway,
yeah.
you know, there was a sidebar on his childhood in like former Yugoslavia. And we had one sentence that sort of categorized the conflict. And originally, I think the writer had civil war. We changed it to multi-ethnic conflict because we believed that that was more accurate. And then there was like a phrase that was basically like, and NATO bombed the Serbian aggressors. So I put this whole section into ChatGPT and I said, is this factually accurate? And it came back and said, well, it's subjective because, you know, some people don't believe that the Serbians were the aggressors. And so then I said, what would somebody who is aligned with NATO believe? Like, if we take the factual reality of this article to be within the realm of what NATO would perceive as aggression, where does that logic land your truth? And they would say, like, well, people who are aligned with NATO would say objectively Serbians were the aggressors. And so we ended up like leaving that in because it was meant to be what the assessment was of the Western world at the time. But there's, I'm bringing to that like more than a decade of immersion in mainstream journalism and journalistic values where like you have to call two sources. I was an intern at NPR when the Supreme Court legalized gay marriage, and I was sitting there with my finger on the Twitter button for NPR waiting for somebody to run over and say that they had double verified it before I hit tweet. And for people who haven't grown up in that world, there is a crisis of media literacy, and you can't even attribute it all to ChatGPT because that's just a symptom.
Well, this is like a creator economy thing too, and like a fragmentation and a deinstitutionalizing.
Yes, absolutely. And this goes back to Colin. Sorry, I don't want to, but there was something you said earlier that really made me think about this, where you're talking about like brute forcing credibility through all these signifiers, like having a nice apartment that you actually rented, which is the same people that pushed for the death of expertise now want to benefit from positioning themselves as experts and experts in everything. So they've done the work. They've brute forced the Forbes mention through paying for one of like the franchised Forbes China things. You know, there's agencies that do this, and they've, you know, they've created the TikTok presence and the rented hotel rooms and the rented homes. And now they want to have an opinion on geopolitics. It's like, guess what? Nobody even gets to have an opinion because we don't even have experts anymore.
I'm so happy you say this because I find this problem with a lot of the kind of Silicon Valley era from 2005 to, you know, 20, where like, if you were there, you participated in like literally like the most insane sort of upswing of wealth, even if you were working at like yahoo.com and like the ad sales department. But a lot of these people then think that they get to be like Marcus Aurelius on shit, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and, you know, I'm kind of subtweeting the All In pod, right?
100%.
You know, like, and it's really, because that's the, you know, that's the next level of like social capital is like fluency to talk about like healthcare policy and like dexterity with, and like, it's so funny to see these guys who were so, like obstinate and like I'm right about this thing in the past couple days, you know, with tariffs. And it's funny to watch like the hemming and hawing of Ackman, who certainly loves to, you know, profess and hold forth. And to tell you the truth, like I very much do not agree with that guy on a lot of things, but like, you know, he's actually a pretty smart character and like a pretty good investor. But like the way he comes off in like this new information environment is like night and day versus like if you actually probably would talk to that guy in a social context. So there is this sort of Joker-esque quality that kind of plays out with some of these people. And also there's the grifters who are some no-name private equity guy that like artificially has lots of followers. It's always in every thread with like the titans of industry, and just by proximity it could make another person feel like they're in the same room or like plane of credibility, you know. And it's very interesting, but it's all it's all built off. It's like the mortgage backed securities of credibility.
Well, so much of this stuff, too, right? Is like you can profess a variety of opinions that may be contradicting. But what matters is that you do profess them, and you profess a lot of them frequently on Twitter. And then the ones that were wrong, you can go back and delete those tweets. And then you look like yeah. you're right. You're just kind of leveraging every point of view.
It's like, yeah. it's like the atomized version of like a Michael Burry or something, right? Minus the actual conviction and the skin in the game.
Conviction, who needs that?
Well, these guys all land-pilled themselves. Like, they bought into this idea that like what we don't really need is a democracy. We need a democracy for people that are sort of above the polls, the smart people. Those people should be able to give opinions. And like, as we know, opinions are like assholes because everyone has one. And these guys, like, it's like, yeah, you know what should be in a data room for a Series A round. That's true. And I'm sure you have some pretty informed opinions on, like, what San Francisco should look like or what your child's school should look like because you have direct interface with them. Now you have lived experience. But to take your area of expertise, which is venture capital, and your lived experience, which is things that have to do with your family, and somehow think that that Frankensteins you into being above the prole in your opinions of politics when you don't know anything about what
you're describing, like a return of like voting rights only to white male landowners, right? Like that's kind of what this goes.
But they know that it's wrong to say that and even think that. So they have to turn it into some sort of ambient, like super Marcus Aurelius class of people who have an exercise agency, but they have no concept of the fact that like, even if such a superclass existed, it probably wouldn't even include them.
Mm-hmm. And that's funny, and it's so interesting because like when I observe a lot of this class, it's like I'm wealthy, and therefore I go into the Loro Piana store and I buy everything off the mannequin. Like I buy the look, right? I buy like the package of like what I think. You know, I should be.
What's the term? Old money, the old money look or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? And it's like the starter pack, right? Mm-hmm. I have that AP that's hard to come by. And I bought the mannequin at the Loro Piana fucking Palo Alto store, right? I'm very much subtweeting right now, but I won't name names. but it's, you know, it's fun. It's funny to observe.
Well, okay. What it is, it's like putting in your ChatGPT reading list. It's like doing that, but instead of give me the things to read and engage with, it's just give me the products to consume that I'm not going to engage with on a deeper level.
Yeah, and it's interesting because parlaying this a little bit into like we're going to do a little hospitality riff here. I think that this type of audience. The good side of this is like perhaps some of these audiences are looking for something different in terms of like the experiences and like how they move throughout the world. They want the enlightened version of this, might be staying at a hotel that doesn't have to like reflect their ego back to them, where it's a little bit more discreet, intuitive, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't have to be like the French Palace, which is like very on the nose of like your ego. But I'm wondering how both the bad side of the sort of new money and the tech wealth manifests itself in what we build in terms of like hospitality experiences, projects, and like where that's going to net out over the next 10 years. Because like something like Aman started out as this very vibey, interesting thing built by a visionary Adrian Zecca. And it's turned itself into like the G-Wagon of like hospitality and kind of conspicuous consumption. So I'm just wondering like where this will all end up.
Well, the other loop here is like we're talking about the LLMs and the Arabic LLM. It seems like you're talking about like how does the ideology of this class of people get baked into new hospitality?
Yeah. And I actually think it's interesting because there are people that have like done the work and they're interesting that have potentially done well, but aren't like screaming it from the rooftops. They're like potentially wearing like a Garmin watch instead of like this AP, you know, and are looking for something that is intuitive and thoughtful and well-constructed. You know, I used to stay at this hotel in Hong Kong called the Upper House, which was very much that. It was just like, everyone was on the same page. Things would happen incredible design, but it wasn't ostentatious and it wasn't in your face. Whereas I think a lot of the new Princelings and kind of Silicon Valley gang, they probably in some ways want that ostentation, right? Mm-hmm. They it's like, this is the ostentation I was promised, you know, if I got here. And so I think that it might bifurcate, right? You might have some experiences which are subtle and intuitive, and then maybe some of these crypto bros actually want the more ostentatious codes of older luxury, Stad Palace.
Well, wait, a term, right? A term you used, I listened to your appearance on the Hospitality Daily podcast, and you used this term irrational hospitality, which I'd love to hear you weave in here.
Yeah, you know, I think what with that is, it's like hospitality that is not beholden to the CFO, right? Where it's like something that is like beautifully done that doesn't make sense cost wise, but is like deep and interesting. You know what I mean? Like something that would annoy a cost cutter or someone that lives in spreadsheets all
something
day.
That's not and, scalable.
Yeah. And like, you know, I think I probably built some of that riff off of like Rory Sutherland's thing, you know, which is like some of the best things are these irrational or contrarian things that would probably piss off your CFO. And you know, the hospitality brands that are not beholden to, you know, a holding company or a CEO that, or CFO that's trying to like manage costs, like they're able to do some of those irrational touches that like make you feel acknowledged or you don't feel like you're being nickeled and dimed. And I think that that's what's happened with luxury over the past several years post pandemic, is it's just like nickel and dime core, right? You know, you're at a place in Mexico and you're being charged, you know, Tribeca prices. So even the very, very wealthy of the world, they're like, oh, you think I'm a fucking idiot. You know what I mean? It can be actually very offensive to, I was talking to a friend who now runs Equinox Hotels, but he was like, I think president, COO, Four Seasons for a long time. And he's like, I have people that will stay with me that will not blink an eye at the $10,000 suite, you know, for a week. That's what it costs. That's the standard. But like, if you try to nickel and dime them, it will be like an unforgivable offense, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting. But I don't know. I just find that.
Which is kind of like a free shipping versus having to pay any other amount for shipping, price in the shipping.
Yeah, you know, it's the you're really going to charge me for like the mini bar when I'm paying for the suite. Yeah. Yeah. But I the reason why I find this so fascinating is like hospitality is always an interesting like reflection of, or luxury is a reflection of like the zeitgeist, but sometimes there's latency in terms of like the builds and the things that are created. And so I'm always interested in like the lag of like where the trend is versus where things are going or manifested in the world. But what has been, for both of you guys, what has been a stay or an experience that has made you feel like huddled or enhanced or excited? You know, it could be a hotel, could be staying at a friend's house. Like, what are two hospitality experiences for you both that really blew your hair back?
Well, my friend Alex, when I sit at her house, she always gives me hotel slippers, which is incredible because hotels don't even give you hotel slippers anymore. And I always compliment her on it. And also every time we stay, there's the guest room has the nightstand on either side with a stack of books. And she personalizes one stack of books to my husband's interests and one stack of books to my interests with a couple of joke books thrown in. It's unbelievable.
That's incredible.
It is really incredible.
I love that you said that because there was a really, someone told me a great example of, they stayed at a hotel, I think it was the Goring in London, mm-hmm. and they had brought a book off the shelf and they read it and they had a bookmark in it and then they like left. And like 3 years later, the hotel had made a note of the place in the book and had the book like it on the nightstand with the same point in the book, like several years on. And like that gives like, that makes the hair stand up on my arm, right? Because that's exactly the intentionality that you're getting at with your I mean, obviously a friend.
Why didn't they mail it back though?
No, it was borrowed from the hotel.
Oh, I see. I see. Okay.
Yeah. So it wasn't, and the one that I like, the example that also happened to a friend of mine too, is like at Parkai Tokyo, I forgot some stuff. I was going somewhere and I was coming back. And instead of bothering me, they just put the stuff in a different room that I was in the same place that it was. And they like didn't even say anything. And it was very interesting because it was that Japanese sort of omotenashi anticipatory thing, not being obtrusive. Because if you think about another brand, it would be like, your St. Regis butler took note of the fact that you left these things. And yeah, we've, you know what I mean? They would have made it a performative thing. But like the Japanese thing was so subtle because it's like, we're not even going to bother you, because the imposition of reminding you that you forgot something is actually kind of burdensome. Mm. We're actually just going to do the thing that is the most elegant and the most seamless. And I'm really excited by those types of notions of hospitality, because that's the poetry. That's the compound interest of like a relationship that you've built with a hotel, you know, over time. And that's why I find this space so fascinating. But I wanted to ask for your take on this too.
Okay. Yeah.
Anything that you really stood out?
I mean, the one thing that instantly came to mind was just last year, my fiance and I stayed at a Airbnb in Berlin for a few days or like a week. And I mean, the nickel and diming thing, on the thing, it's like, oh, you know, we've got bicycles in the basement you can rent for $10 a day, etc. But then we settled in and we got there and we ended up like chatting with her for like an hour and a half or 2 hours, and in a way where it's like, you know, we've just got off the plane. It was like we left New York at midnight and then we got there at 1 p.m. We're a little tired, but it was just like a nice conversation. And she's like, oh, here's this map where like, you know, go to this lake. And in a way where like after an hour, she's like, usually this doesn't happen. Like usually it's like 15 minutes or so, but then she gave us the bikes and she was like the bike keys. And she's like, you know, just ride them. Like it doesn't matter. But then at the end, when we were leaving her, we'd like cross paths with her partner who was coming to lock up and such. And, she was saying like, I forget the woman's name. I think it was like Mary or something, but she said that Mary said like, oh, you guys have discussed, maybe you want to move here for a year or something. Like, here's her number. Like, I think she actually would love to rent you the place if you wanted to, you know, like off of Airbnb, but just normally rent it. And in a way where like, I prefer to stay in a hotel than an Airbnb these days. It's always the extra fees and the quality poor, whatever. But this was like, I don't know, this felt like the original proposition, right? Where it's like, here's a person who you're going to engage with as a person, who's going to engage with you as a person. And like, now this is somebody whose email I have, who like, I could just rent this apartment from her for a year.
That's really exciting too, because it gets us back to this notion of like neighborliness, right? Yeah. You know, and you're so right, because that was the original proposition, right? Of like, because I have this relationship with this person, thus the manners and the way I'm going to treat this place is with respect. And like, unfortunately, like that's out the window with like the way these things are scaled, right? On the host side, it's like, let me give you a fucking list of chores to do, you know? And I'm going to nickel and dime you with like all these fees to boost my margins. And then on the guest side, it's like, I'm just going to trash this place or treat it as if like, you know, I'm going to scuff my luggage on the wall and treat it as if it's the Holiday Inn. And this is the thing that in culture is just like so profoundly upsetting to me. And someone said this the other day. I'm going to quickly find the quote, because it was so spot on. But they, you know, it was basically just about how we're moving through the like the death of manners, and how people are kind of moving through the world as if everyone else is like NPC, right? Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
And
Colin, I saw a similar tweet while you look for it. This one was about how like kindness and decency have become like woke coded. Mm-hmm. And there was a follow-up tweet basically saying that like during the Thatcher era and even Reagan, do-gooder was actually like an epithet that people would use against other people, where you're like, oh, you're a do-gooder or you're a woke. And it goes back to this idea of like the new wealth, where it's like old money, as like paternalistic as it was, there was this sense that like the more money you earn, the more duty you have towards the common good. Mm-hmm. And that sense of civic duty is completely out the window. Like VCs will leave their job at their firm to go work in Washington, but they're not doing it because they have a sense of duty to the common good. They're doing it to enrich themselves and their friends. And I think it's disgusting.
This goes back to the whole Marcus Aurelius conversation.
Yeah, and I don't
think... I love that you said that. Yeah, it's like... it's because that's the next level of the capital rung, mm-hmm. as opposed to like, I made my money and now it's my time to serve. Right. Mm-hmm. I love that point. And I'm finding this, I'm scrolling through the comments to find this, quote, cause it's just so good. But, it's just about, it's about that, toes out on the airplane, watching TikToks out loud.
Yeah.
The sort of everyone else is just an NPC, and I'm just like moving throughout the world, you know. The social contract is dead. Zoom calls in coffee shops, music allowed on the subway, texting in movie theaters, toes out on airplanes. Everyone has main character energy now and thinks the rest of the world is a bunch of NPCs. The more you stare at a screen, the more you feel like you can do anything you want IRL, since other humans just wind up seeming like avatars you can ignore, commenters you can mute, or gang members you can run over in Grand Theft Auto. And like, I don't know. I know a lot of people are frustrated with this, but I don't know what is required to kind of get back to neighborliness, because part of this is pandemic. Part of this is like social media trances where people are like not in touch with like their environment. But I was picking up a coffee the other day and some guy was just like watching something at like level 11 in the coffee shop. And I was like, I'm not going to get into it with this guy just because I just don't want to fucking do that. But if I was sitting trying to read or study for like an exam, like it's just like a pollutant, you know? Yeah. And it's that, so I think that I used to think the antidote to this was, like hotels and these spaces, like having a little bit more backbone in terms mm-hmm. of like what they will and won't stand
for. Like the customer actually isn't always right.
Yeah. The customer isn't always right. But the problem is what that does is it penalizes like the frontline staff who are just trying to do their jobs and like don't want to have to pick fights with people that can potentially be of like different status, where mm-hmm. it's like some person be like, do you know who I am? I'll get you fired. I know the manager, you know? And so I don't know, but I do think that like there is I'm sensing a current among thinking people about how bad this has gotten and how it needs to be like reined in. But I don't know how.
I don't know. Fixed, I think know? Like the institution has to stand behind the worker. Like I'm reading Graydon Carter's memoir right now, and they're talking about people that they had to ban from the Vanity Fair Oscars party, and he basically said like, you could be as rude as you want to me. But the second that you're rude to somebody of my staff, you're banned for life. It doesn't matter who you are. Courtney Love got banned. And yeah. I think we have to bring back some of that mentality where like there is a corollary to decency, which is shame. And I think that there is a way to appeal to people's conscience, which isn't like videotaping people at the dog park or videotaping people having an argument on the subway. But I think we need to bring back this sort of like, this is funny, like when I was growing up, it was called like Matthew Code, which is something from the Bible, which is like, when you have a problem, you go to them directly. I think it's in Matthew. So it's called like the Matthew Code. But it's just like this one-to-one appeal that doesn't have to take place on the internet, but can be like, hey man, can you take your feet down from the chair? And I think, I mean, not to say that this goes all the way up to so many different issues, but I think the fact that people could be armed in American society impacts people's like willingness to confront other people. I mean, there's a lot of things about this social contract breaking down that aren't just people's solipsism and spending time online. It's that like, we're not like really a peaceful society.
I like what you're saying though, is there a way to like modulate this in a way that's like non-threatening, but is snapping someone out of like a trance, right? Because mm-hmm. it's like, if you're assuming good intent, sometimes that works, right? And I've actually done that in like airports where I'm like, excuse me, can you just put headphones on? People are like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I was like talking to my, nephew and I was like entranced with the thing. And like, but then other people are like, go fuck yourself, you know? Yeah. So, but I think the point that to put a bow on it, and I have to get moving because I'm going to get kicked out of this room in 2 seconds. But like the to put a bow on it is I think what you talked about with your Airbnb experience and you know, Daisy, your hospitality experience is like a neighborliness, an anticipation, an empathy, right? And like that is so powerful, and it can, and honestly, like people that lose their jobs or are having a bad day, it's like when you call them and just say, hey, I'm just thinking about you, no agenda, I'm here. And like people are like blown away because no one does that anymore, right?
If you want to have, yeah, sorry.
I think we could end it there.
Yeah.
We and can say, listener, we're thinking about you.
We're thinking about you. Listening. If you want to have a high trust society, you have to extend trust and build the community that you build the community and the hospitality you want to see in the world.
And what I think about to put a bow on it is like, I liked the anecdotes from Graydon about like the personal correspondence, the flowers for the first article in the mag, the art, you know, it's like these analog acknowledgements, which are in our society today, in the sort of tech society, have a disproportionate amount of weight. They hit you like a ton of bricks that someone actually took the time. But speaking of which, thank you so much for having me. I think we covered a lot of like ground, and I'm very flattered to have been asked. And so thank you.
Thank you.